Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. I'm Travis Hornsby, and today I wanted to do a little bit of a hybrid episode, which means that I want to do a little bit of everything. So first, we're going to address a couple of reader and listener questions that I got that I think would probably really apply to a lot of folks. And then I thought I would go into discussion of student debt cancellation and just all the different opinions, feelings, what people are talking about, what is the chatter around student debt cancellation, and could it have implications for your taxes for your forgiven student loan debt, potentially not having to pay tax on that anymore? Could that happen because of the student debt cancellation movement? And then finally, I've got an interview with a advisor, Justin Sloan, that I think you'll enjoy. So everything together, this will be a great episode. I'm excited to dig in. So first, let's look at one of the questions that we got. This question is from, we'll just call him B. That's his first name. So he says he's a dental student who's going to graduate with about $300,000 in student loan debt. He's going into a practice for a year, and then he wants to apply for a dental specialty residency program. So just for those that don't know, the dental specialty residencies tend to be programs where you have to pay instead of get paid. So unlike medicine, where you get paid, you know, $50,000 to $70,000 for your years of training and residency, for dentists, if you want to go on and be a periodontist, a prosthodontist, a, you know, orthodontist, endodontist, oral surgeon, in most cases, pediatric dentist, in most cases, you have to get into a program where you actually have to pay money instead of purely getting paid. So that's one reason dental specialists tend to have the highest student loan debts of any of our clients as a category. And so anyways, that's a little background. So B says, I'm going to have $300K in student loan debt. And I'm going to be applying for an ortho residency. I'm going to have an income and then I'll be a student again. And this person asks, you know, maybe I was thinking what I should do is consolidate everything, do the revised pay-as-you-earn plan. And he asks, I didn't file taxes the past year, so I have no tax return to show income. What do you suggest doing in this scenario? So this is a really great question. What I would suggest, first of all, is file a tax return. If you have zero income, you can actually go back and file a tax return years in the past with a $0 income if you owe nothing. In other words, there's no penalty for filing late if your income is zero because you owe nothing. So a lot of times what I'll tell somebody who's graduating and has no income is, well, if you didn't file a tax return in the previous year, go into any tax software out there. It should be pretty much free. You just go in, enter zero for everything and submit it. And now you have a tax return. Now there's no question that you actually have a provable AGI of zero to show to get a $0 payment on your monthly student loan payment. Now, obviously, right now you don't have to worry about that because the payments are all paused. But at some point, that'll end. And so that's the way you want to handle that is go back and go ahead and file a tax return. Even if it doesn't feel right, it feels a little weird, just go ahead and do that because there's no penalty. And the only additional point I would make to this person is if you're thinking about doing the revised pay-as-you-earn plan, that's probably not the right plan in this case, depending on what the cost of going to the ortho program will be. You know, if you go to ortho, especially at one of the high-cost schools, you'll probably leave with a total of $500,000 to $600,000 of student loan debt coming out. And if you already have 300, that'll continue to grow while you're in your program too. So it's not unthinkable that you'll come out earning $200,000 to $400,000, but you'll owe $600,000 of student debt. And in that situation, I would almost be tempted to tell somebody, maybe you should do the pay as you earn instead of the repay. And the reason is you have to double check, is your income going to be high enough to pay the debt back and make that make sense? If the answer is no, because let's say you want to live in a big area where there's lots of competition, but it's a really fun place to live, then maybe you should set yourself up to go for forgiveness and make sure you optimize for going for forgiveness, which means giving yourself the shortest period for forgiveness possible and not worrying about the interest. So a lot of times people focus on the interest when what you should be really focusing on is what is the payment and what is my life plan? What do I plan? What do I want to do with my life? Do I want to live in the middle of nowhere and make a ton of money where paying back my loans would make the most sense? Or if I'm going to live in some bigger city, you know, where my income is going to be more capped because of all the competition, maybe I should take advantage of a free forgiveness program and realize that's probably what I'm going to be doing regardless. Next question, which I think is also a really good one. This one comes in also from, we'll call this person M. So M asks, I am in the final year of my medical school and I'm graduating with about $200,000 of student loans and I'm planning on pursuing forgiveness via PSLF. I've got a lot of interest that has accrued during my time until graduation. I've not made any payments on this, and it's accrued throughout medical school. I've been wondering if it would make sense to make a one-time payment on the interest to keep it from capitalizing. thereby reducing future required payments or save the money I would have spent on interest, since a lot of it would be forgiven in 10 years. I have the savings to pay the accrued interest now, but I can imagine the benefits to allowing the capitalization to occur and using the money for other purposes. So this is another great question. The simple answer to this one is never, ever, ever pay a dime towards something that's going to be forgiven, no matter how painful it feels not making the payment, no matter how guilty you feel not making the payment. I feel somewhat guilty that we have this massive debt that's accumulating with all of us, and we're not being asked to pay any extra taxes to cover that large debt, right? That large national debt or anything. But that doesn't mean that I should go out and pay a bunch of voluntary taxes, because that's just not how taxes work. Any extra payments that I would make would be a drop in the bucket compared to what everybody in society would need to make to make sure that we, you know, don't have as big of a budget deficit, for example. I'm just throwing this out as just a hypothetical example, I guess. The thing I'm trying to point out is that if something's said to be forgiven, any extra dollars you pay are literally gone. It's similar to taking a bunch of cash and renting a wood chipper or something and going out and dumping all of your cash in the wood chipper and turning the switch and watching it all come out the other end as confetti. It's very similar to that. So when you're going for forgiveness, you could care less about the interest accruing. It could be 10%. It could be 15%. Ultimately, it doesn't really matter, because the interest on student loans accrues, meaning it does not compound. So it grows a lot slower than a compounding rate of interest does. And then the other thing is, if you're going for forgiveness, you're going for forgiveness no matter what, and 10% of your income is the same no matter what. And then if you're saving for the tax bomb, that will increase the amount you have to save for the tax bomb if you happen to have a lot of accumulated interest. But the thing is with PSLF, it's tax-free. And even if you were pursuing taxable forgiveness where you were expecting to owe a tax bomb, the additional extra amount that you would owe is a fraction of what you would have to pay to account for it. So for example, let's say that you have $100,000 that's going to be a tax bomb, and well, you actually only have to pay 40% of that. And if you pay 40% of that, you're paying that 20 years from now instead of today. So that's obviously a big difference, right? That's a big difference in the payment. And so if you look at the cost in today's dollars, that's literally like paying 15 cents today is the value of that in today's dollars. So if it doesn't make sense for you to trade a dollar for 15 cents today, don't make any extra payments on your loans. And that's for taxable for forgiveness. If you're talking about PSLF, you pay a dollar now and you're literally getting back $0 if your plan is eventually to go for PSLF. So great question. Be really careful about paying anything, you know, when you really shouldn't, because you're going for forgiveness. And don't be afraid of interest capitalizing. It's really not nearly as bad as it might seem. All right, now let's talk about a little bit different topic. Let's talk about student debt cancellation. So there's been tons of talk about this topic. It's been really a buzz on social media. A lot of experts have discussed it in ad nauseum in really great detail. And so, you know, can you do it via legislation? The answer there is, of course you can. So for those that are not up to date with this conversation, essentially President-elect Biden wants to do $10,000 of cancellation of student debt for every American. That would cost a little over $330 billion, approximately. So that's been something that has been a big topic of conversation. Now, initially, the expectation, or the kind of the default base case scenario, was that Democrats would have control over the House and the Senate and the White House. That was kind of the expected outcome if you look at betting markets from this election. And then something unexpected happened, where President-elect Biden won the election, and then the Democrats in the House actually lost seats, lost maybe, it seems like maybe around 10 seats or so. And so their majority narrowed. And then in the Senate, it appears that the Republicans will either control the Senate or the Democrats will control it by the narrowest of margins, 50 Democrats to 50 Republicans, with Kamala Harris, the vice president, being the tiebreaker that would send the control of the Senate to Democrats, right? So with such a narrow margin, getting things done legislatively on student loans, it's going to be a lot more difficult without major compromise. Now, if you look at the HEROES Act was the big stimulus bill that the House Democrats proposed after the initial big stimulus for the pandemic that did all the PPP and all the different stimulus checks, everything. That was the big bill that came out that was their proposal. It was about $3.4 trillion initially. They dropped a bunch of things out of it. One of the things they dropped was the request to cancel $10,000 of student debt for everyone. So you might ask, well, why did they decide to take that out? The main reason is because they were trying to, both sides were, I guess, trying, it depends on what your word choice there is. Theoretically, both sides are trying to pass some sort of stimulus that they can both agree on, right? Democrats wanted $3.4 trillion. Republicans wanted $500 billion. That's very far apart. And one of the things the Democrats did in trying to negotiate was they decided, well, you know what? We can axe this request for cancellation of student debt. So they dropped that request because it scored a lot more expensive than they thought it would when the Congressional Budget Office, which is a nonpartisan organization, scored their bill and found that student debt cancellation would cost way more than what they were saying that it would cost, right? So this kind of thing is I think, fairly typical. The CBO, it tends to be a little bit more wonkish and technical in their analysis of things. And they try to be somewhat conservative with policy judgments because they don't want to seem like they're coming down on one side or the other. One thing that you'll see a lot of times on both sides of the equation, Republicans will tend to say, well, these tax cuts will all pay for themselves, right? So even if it says it's a cost of $2 trillion over 10 years, it's not really true because there'll be feedback effects and it'll cost way less than that. And then Democrats will often say, well, this government spending actually pays for itself. This $2 trillion will pay for itself because there are multiplier effects where people will take this money and spend it in the economy several times over. And therefore, we shouldn't even be thinking about this as a cost because it will pay for itself. The CBO tries to take more of a middle view, which is things cost what they cost. So if you think about the cancellation of $10,000 of student loan debt, if you increase that to cancellation of $50,000 of student loan debt, you're talking about closing in on at least on $1 trillion. Now it's, you know, a lot of the discussion is as well, if we can afford to do $2 trillion in tax cuts for the rich, we can certainly do, you know, cancel all student loan debt. Like that's definitely a progressive policy position that is, you know, very supported by the leaders of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. The question is will it actually happen? So I think my analysis is that legislatively, student debt cancellation is extremely unlikely. The only way that that would happen is if you had a Great Depression style situation where you had significant deflation. We talk about inflation where prices go way up, you know, and money becomes worth less and less. That's great for people in debt because that means that the real value of your debt is a lot less than it was before that inflation. Now with deflation, basically the value of money actually increases. Basically the interest rates in the economy actually go negative. And then you have the situation where a dollar tomorrow might actually be worth more than it was today. And that's where things get really messed up. And that's where debtors really get obliterated is, you know, imagine if you have a, you know, $100,000 mortgage, but then there's deflation. And so that $100,000 mortgage really more feels more like $110,000 without you even doing anything. That's where things get really stressful. And so I think that, you know, you might see the cancellation movement get a little bit quieter if there's significant inflation because people would be a little less concerned about it in that case. You kind of would have student debt cancellation, but just through like a backdoor window instead of through the front door. That would be kind of an interesting thing if that happened. Why is cancellation unlikely? It's just because you'd have to get a supermajority of progressive Democrats to be willing to do that. If you think about the policy of student debt cancellation, it's fairly easy to attack it and sort of make it a political target. And the reason why is because 2/3 of people don't go to college. So opponents have a very easy line of attack where they say, well, it's unfair to cancel student debt because people without degrees are paying for it. Now, in reality, this is probably high earners that would pay for this. You'd raise taxes significantly on people that make a lot of money, and then you would probably try to pay for it that way. So you could say, well, actually, no, it's the high earners that would pay for this student debt cancellation. Then you might have the other side counter yet again and say, well, actually, if you did student debt cancellation, it would take away from other programs. It would take away from other progressive priorities like paid family leave, expanding healthcare access and programs, maintaining and expanding the safety net, etc. So if you really think about that, there's good arguments on both sides of that. So I don't necessarily think that there's any chance it happens legislatively. Why do I think that? Think about the Senate. The Senate's going to be where the real action is from what gets done in the next 2.5 years or so. And who in the Senate will be the key decision makers? It's going to be that person that's the 50th vote or the 51st vote on any kind of bill, right? And who would that be if the Republicans control the chamber? It would be Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Senator Susan Collins of Maine, and Senator Mitt Romney of Utah. So those three were the ones that were sort of the mavericks of this last Senate grouping, which was 53 Republicans in it. And you had the Vice President Pence was able to cast the tie-breaking vote on things. So those three were the ones that consistently defected on a lot of different things. And their power is going to be magnified no matter what happens with this special election in Georgia for those two open Senate seats. So you know, either you're going to have the center of the Senate be around these moderate Republicans, or if the Democrats win both of those seats in Georgia, then you're going to have it be Senator Joe Manchin. And who is this? This is the West Virginia senator who is one of the most shocking senators in the country, really, just simply because he won election as a Democrat in a state that voted by over 40% more for President Trump than by President-elect Biden. And so he's somebody that almost like you would look at him and think, wow, this person shouldn't be able to win election in a place like that. How does he win? He really understands like the working class voters in West Virginia, and only 17% of people in West Virginia actually have a four-year degree. So he is very unlikely to be the key person that's going to support canceling student loan debt when it's something that probably his voters would not look well upon. So I think just legislatively, right, student debt cancellation is totally dead. I don't think there's any chance that it happens no matter what, unless there's a Great Depression. Can you cancel student loan debt then at all? The question then becomes, can you cancel student loan debt via an executive order? Now, there is a code in the Higher Education Act that gives the Secretary of Education the power to modify debt, interest rates, etc. But the question is does that mean that that power is broad-based? Does that mean that you can do whatever you want at a large, high-scale level to student debt, maybe cancel the whole thing? Is that possible? The reality is opinions really vary on this among student loan experts. If I kind of just do a quick and dirty poll of Twitter and look at all the student loan experts that I know of Twitter, generally what I find is people who are very much progressives and would identify as like left of the Democratic Party, who are more very public part of interest groups, right? People lobbying on behalf of student loan borrowers for specific policy outcomes, right? Those folks would say, yes, it's definitely legal to do this. The president definitely has this authority in the Higher Education Act, just cancel all student loan debt. If I look at the more moderate wing of the party, maybe you could look at these folks as maybe like the Biden wing of the Democratic Party, the more moderate wing, they tend to, I think, not be sure. I think they tend to think, well, maybe he has this power, but should he use it? Or maybe he doesn't have this power because of X, Y, and Z. It's not clear. And then, you know, I guess the conservatives kind of look at this and say, heck no, he doesn't have this power, right? So there's this big disagreement among people who are student loan experts in the partisan sense. And what I mean by that is, you know, I try to make sure that we do a good job of just kind of explaining what we think will happen and won't happen. And we try not to lean too hard into what we think should happen. And the reason for that is just because I want to make sure that we're just, our primary job is just to look out for your interests and your finances and try to make sure that no matter who's in office or whatever policies exist, that you can be successful financially. But there's obviously plenty of people that maybe work at the Brookings Institution or the American Enterprise Institute, or might work for the Republicans on the Higher Education Committee in the Senate, right, that will be experts in student loans, but they might have a public partisan orientation. And so that's what I think is real interesting, to follow those people in particular to see what they think is possible via student debt cancellation via executive order. So here's another big question. Is it taxable? If you had $10,000 of student debt forgiven, would it be considered taxable income? And the answer is, it seems like this is something that everyone agrees on. The answer, it seems, is yes. So if you had $10,000 of student loan debt that was canceled, under current law, that would be considered taxable income. Now, what does that mean? If your debts are larger than your assets, then you'd be considered insolvent. And you would simply have to file an insolvency declaration with your tax return that would show basically no assets or assets that are lower than what your debt is, and then the debt would be forgiven tax-free. But let's say that, you know, you have $100,000 of assets and $50,000 of student debt. If they canceled $10,000, your net worth is positive, therefore you're not insolvent. Therefore, that $10,000 would be considered taxable income. So let's say you are in the 25% bracket, and that means you'd pay $2,500 on that $10,000 of canceled student loan debt. In some cases, this could be really bad for people pursuing forgiveness. In fact, it could be a huge negative. Here's an example. Pretend that you have a positive net worth and you're pursuing public service loan forgiveness. Your debt's going to be forgiven anyway, and your debt's probably much larger than the typical debt of the typical American. Say that $10,000 of debt is canceled. Well, if it was canceled via the PSLF program, it's tax-free. But since it's canceled via an executive order, it would be considered a taxable event, and you would have to pay income taxes on that. Let's say you're in the top marginal tax bracket because you're a surgeon in a high income kind of situation. So you're at 37% for your marginal tax rate. And let's say you're in California, so that's 10% for California tax. So you're at 47%. And now your income on your AGI is higher for next year. So you also have 10% higher student loan payments the following year because of that canceled student loan debt. So because of $10,000 of canceled student loan debt, you now have to pay $5,700 higher payments on your taxes and your student loan payments combined. So because that student debt was eventually going to be forgiven via the PSLF program, student debt cancellation in that regard could actually cost you money. You could lose thousands of dollars if President-elect Biden on day one signs an order to cancel $10,000 of student loan debt without addressing the taxability of student debt cancellation. So here's a really interesting question. What would happen if President-elect Biden tried to also issue an executive order that stated student debt cancellation will no longer be considered a taxable event, or just basically said student debt forgiveness will no longer be considered a taxable event? That is really, really interesting. Because if that happened, then that could potentially affect the forgivability of debt just in the traditional 20 and 25 year pay and repay plans. This is really crazy interesting what's going on with all the nuance behind the scenes, how something as simple as just discussing of canceling student loan debt could potentially impact you in such a positive way as to maybe wipe away the tax liability of your forgiven student loan debt if you're pursuing a forgiveness strategy in the private sector. You know, I think regardless of what happens, I think that eventually the tax bomb will get wiped away, but I don't think it's going to be for the reasons why we think. I think it could be inadvertently wiped away, but then if it was inadvertently wiped away, I do think that people would recognize that and Republicans would challenge it, because I think that what's going on is the Republican Party obviously doesn't like the government's involvement in the student loan markets. I think they think that increases costs and that it makes it crowds out private lending, that kind of thing. And so why have they not addressed this problem of the taxability of the forgiven student loan debt? It's just because it's a bargaining chip. If you have that big bargaining chip, you don't want that to go away, because you could use that to give that up in exchange for higher payments. For example, if I want the required payment of people's income to be 15% instead of 10, I might be willing to trade the taxation on the forgiven student loan debt in exchange for permanently increasing the required percentage of your income to 15% instead of 10. So there's all kinds of really interesting discussions that are going to happen with this. I would expect that Vice President, now President-elect, soon to be President Biden, I would expect that Biden will try something aggressive via an executive order. I think that it would not surprise me if he does an executive order that pauses the payments and interest on student loans. I think that is fairly likely that might happen. President Trump might actually end up doing that too by the time this podcast comes out. I think that either one are possible, but just realize that this student debt cancellation, it's not going to really help anybody listening to this podcast, because if you only have 10K of student loan debt, I mean, shoot, go listen to true crime or something, right? Because I mean, once you're done, I don't blame you if you start turning over to Serial and The Bachelorette podcast, if you focus on those instead. I mean, I understand. I'm not going to blame you. But I think that in all reality, like if you have the kind of debt that our average person in our community does, student debt cancellation is absolutely not going to help you. And it might end up actually hurting you because of this nuance in the tax code that just started getting discussed more recently. And the thing that I'd say is, regardless of what happens, people continue to book plans like crazy during this time, which is something that kind of surprised me. Like I've said, that's cool. We'd love to get plans for you. If you want to get a plan, get one as soon as possible, because I think that it's the sooner you get a plan, the sooner you stop making mistakes. So the last thing that I wanted to do in today's show is I wanted to interview a financial planner who is part of Buckingham Group, which is a sponsor of our site, Student Loan Planner. And I wanted to have him on. In particular, he talks about a few things that I think are pretty interesting. The importance of not focusing only on tax-deferred plans to grow wealth, which is one thing I like to talk about a lot. He talks about asset location, which is what funds do you put in what account, which can save you a lot of money on taxes long-term. And he also just talks about the trends in the medical world and just the consolidation of the industry and kind of what kind of income ranges he sees and things like that. So here's this interview with Justin Sloan, CFA, CFP from Buckingham Group. Welcome to the podcast, Justin. How's it going?
Yeah, doing great, Travis. Thanks so much for having me on.
I was looking at your bio on your company site, and I've just got to ask you this. You help out with your family winery. Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, really, my folks got into it. It was kind of a second career for them. They just don't know how to, frankly, retire and not do anything. So they just kind of launched into this, and they did so with the expectation that family would get involved and help out. So I'm out there doing anything from pruning the vineyard to helping on harvest day, helping with the website, or even in the tasting room from time to time. So it really is a family ordeal. It's a lot of fun and just something good to do on the side.
Now, do you get paid in wages, stock, or Cabernet?
Primitivo, actually. It's got kind of an Italian theme to the winery there. But yeah, it's all just compensation in wine and just do it out of the love for the family.
Talk to me about what is your typical client profile look like? Obviously, most of our people have graduate degrees in our community. But can you talk about what their debt, income, age, private practice versus not private practice breakdown kind of looks like?
Yeah, so a lot there. The clients that I tend to partner with and feel like I add the most value for, those clients that are a bit younger, are earning a good amount and, you know, have the financial means to be able to save quite a bit for their financial future. And I'd say if I were to make that even more specific, I do have a pretty large group of clients that are physicians.
What's good income? What would you say is the range of incomes that you see?
Yeah, I'd say north of 250, 300. And I think doctors are particularly interesting and ones that I, you know, find myself helping pretty often because they do spend a decent amount of time in med school. And once they do finish all that up, suddenly they have a pretty good income that they're receiving and just need help kind of organizing what to do with it, help prioritize debt versus saving for retirement versus maybe saving for kids' college and so on.
250 to 300, that kind of takes out a lot of the academic specialists, pediatrics, primary care, right? Those are specialties that are significantly below that income range. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, for those folks, I tend to say, well, if you max out your retirement accounts and open a brokerage account, put a couple thousand a month in there, you will likely have a very solid retirement. For the kind of people who really need to have a financial advisor, I mean, you could think of people that have private practice partnerships, complex arrangements, maybe even owning surgical centers. Do you have clients that own assets that are sort of maybe practice equity or surgical centers or something along those lines?
Yeah, to a lesser extent. I think there's just been a lot of consolidation in the field as a whole. As individual doctors out there assess, you know, the risks of having a private practice, you know, a lot of that's getting consolidated and folded into larger groups. And I've seen that across the board with many of my physicians. Within physicians as a whole, I do have a further focus, and that is trauma surgeons, both in my area and across the country. And with them, I've seen significant amount of consolidation, private groups getting folded into much larger groups, so on. So a lot of the practice ownership risks have gone away, and I've seen those risks being held quite a bit more by the larger organizations. And as I talk with many of those physicians that have made that transition, they're much, you know, I'd say their earning potential has more or less been preserved, and they've walked away from a lot of the risks that individual practice owners would have.
Risks like what? Malpractice, insurance premiums, lawsuits? What's the main risk that is driving this?
Yep, you got it. I mean, you hit it on the head right there. That's it. Personal, I'd say risks as well. Just if they're not able to continue to do the services that they do due to disability and that kind of thing, there's a number of different employee benefits and different things that they can get from practicing as part of a larger group.
What are some of those examples? I mean, if somebody goes to work for a hospital, why are the benefits necessarily better?
Just some of those, I'd say the larger groups tend to have better employee benefits that could be available to them. And they just find themselves getting more benefits there rather than as part of a small private group.
What are some examples of some of the money that you've saved someone?
Well, I think the conversation usually starts with a more qualitative discussion around what's important to the family, what's important, you know, to you individually. And once we've kind of had that conversation, we can start to prioritize the different aspects. But I'd say more specifically to your question around how are we saving for retirement and what kind of efficiencies can be had and what kind of decisions are we making there? The way I like to look at it is each tax year is kind of an opportunity. And each year that goes by, you either take advantage of that opportunity or you don't. And whether that's saving into your 401k and taking advantage of tax deferral or, you know, however the plan's structured, I'd say that's one part of it. The other part of it is starting to think about other types of accounts and really, I'd say, setting up your retirement to have a diverse set of accounts that you could potentially draw from. The biggest mistake that I see physicians make, is they'll just look at their 401k and see that as the only vehicle for savings that's going to fund their retirement. And if you do that, you just find yourself with one giant tax-deferred account that you draw from in retirement. You don't really have a diverse set of accounts that you could draw from or take different types of income or recognize different types of taxes as you draw from those accounts.
Why wouldn't I just want a big pot of tax-deferred money that's taxable at retirement?
I'd say the answer to that is inherent in the different types of accounts that are out there. If we just look at three very simple examples and assume the 401k is all tax-deferred dollars, when I draw on that account, I'm recognizing ordinary income from that account as I draw on it. So that's all income that I'm going to pay ordinary income taxes on. And if I just put all of my dollars into there, and I have a pretty significant lifestyle that I want to fund in retirement, I'm going to have to take large distributions that are all taxed at ordinary income tax rates. The opportunity that is out there is there are other types of accounts like Roth IRA accounts, for example, where I could take dollar or get taxed on those dollars up front and take them out completely tax-free in the future. And then the other opportunity that's out there is just saving in, like you said, a brokerage account and letting assets grow at long-term capital gains rates, which is hopefully a tax rate that's much less than those ordinary income tax rates. So I think saving in a diversified way is important because it gives you more financial flexibility to be able to draw from your accounts in the future. And there could be a number of reasons why we want to have that flexibility. I mean, imagine a scenario where you're in retirement, all you have is a tax-deferred account, and let's say you're spending $150,000, $200,000 per year on a regular year. But for whatever reason, one year, there's a significant expense that you need to undertake. Maybe it's the purchase of a vacation home or some other large purchase out there. If the only source that I can go to is that tax deferred account, now all of a sudden I'm throwing more income on top of the stack and it's getting taxed at much higher marginal income rates. So having the flexibility to reach into different types of accounts that are taxed differently just positions you much better to deal with retirement. So to bring it all the way back to the beginning, which is, I think, how do we think about saving in a tax-efficient way for retirement? And that point I made about every year is an opportunity to start designing this financial future and designing these different types of accounts that you can draw from in the future. Each year that goes by is an opportunity to fund those different types of accounts and start accumulating assets in different types of accounts. So when I work with many young physicians, step one is usually, hey, let's defer income. Your income is incredibly high. We're in the highest marginal income tax brackets. Let's defer some of that. So we max out the 401k. Beyond that, we start to look at saving in taxable accounts as well as doing non-deductible IRA contributions and Roth conversions to start building out some of those after-tax accounts.
That makes sense. Justin, do you have any other final tips for our listeners? Anything that they should know about when considering how to build wealth and how a group like yours might be able to help?
Yeah, you know, I'd say the other thing, just to go back to this concept of saving in a diverse way for retirement and not just throwing dollars into a tax-deferred account and really hoping for the best, I'd say is this concept of asset location. It's incredibly, incredibly important that once you start to have a number of different types of accounts that are taxed in different ways, to then come up with an investment plan that puts the right types of assets in those different types of accounts. And that's a concept called asset location. And if you think about it, I think very simply, and this is a gross oversimplification of the concept, but if you have an account, like a tax-deferred account, like your 401k that grows and Uncle Sam shares in a significant percentage of that growth because it's taxed at ordinary income tax rates, in a way, you're disincentivized to grow that type of account. And then if you compare that against a Roth IRA account or a taxable account that is taxed at 0%, in the case of the Roth, or at long-term capital gains rates, you're really incentivized to grow a type of account like that. So as you look at the different assets that you might choose to own in your portfolio, some higher expected return like stocks and some lower expected return like fixed income, you want to make specific decisions about where you're choosing to own those different assets. So simply, I mean, we're trying to own equities inside of accounts like your taxable account, your brokerage account. We're wanting to own equities inside of a Roth IRA account, an account that grows unencumbered by taxes. And we're wanting to own our less tax efficient items and lower expected return items like fixed income and alternatives inside of those tax deferred accounts. asset location is just incredibly important. And as you start to assemble a portfolio with different types of accounts, it's imperative that you get the asset location decision right. Otherwise, you're just going to find yourself sharing more of your investment portfolio growth with a government at the end of the day.
That's a great final tip. Justin, where can people learn about your services and the services at Buckingham more generally if they don't necessarily fit into your specific group?
Yeah, so I'd say just visit our website, look us up online. That's the best place to find more information about me, more information about the organization. We have a number of offices across the country, a number of advisors that work with different types of clients. So I'd say that's the best starting point. And reach out, I'd say, generally to Buckingham. We have a great team that will find the best fit for you, I'd say, across the board. So work with the team, find a good fit for you for advisors that are out there, and best way to go about it.
Thank you so much for being on the show.
All right. Thanks, Travis. Appreciate you having me on.
Thank you, Justin, for that. So again, if you want to have a financial planner, then I think that Buckingham is a solid choice. There's a lot of solid choices out there, but you could certainly give them a look and get a free interview of them, basically. You can do that by going to studentloanplanner.com/FP for like financial planning. So studentloanplanner.com/FP. Basically, you could interview them for free for like 30 minutes, ask them a bunch of questions, see if they're the people to manage your finances. If not, that's great. But I think that a lot of people would benefit from having somebody professionally managing everything. And it is really tough to manage your own finances, honestly, if you've got complex finances in particular. So if you have a very high income, if your time, you'd rather spend it doing other things, if you have complex tax stuff going on, if you're a business owner, if you have side hustles, real estate ventures, anything that makes life a lot more complicated where you don't want to just manage it on your own and do index funds. And even if you do, you might want to hire the services of a financial planner. So if you go to studentloanplanner.com/FP, you'll find ways to connect with advisors like Justin, but also you'll find resources like Vanguard and Betterment if you want to do everything on your own instead. Thank you so much for listening to today's show. Don't forget that you can go to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail to ask your own questions that we will feature if we'd like the question. And then that gets you a little bit of free advice too, right? Thank you, everyone. And I hope that you have a safe time as we approach the holiday season with your family.